You're listening to The World Is Just a Book Away podcast. I'm James Owens, founder and CEO of The World Is Just a Book Away, a nonprofit organization on a mission to promote literacy and education by developing libraries and programs in disadvantaged communities around the world. For more information about The World Is Just a Book Away, please visit www.wijaba.org. That's WIJABA.org. My guest today on The World Is Just a Book Away podcast is Lalagi Snow, who's also known as Lally. Lalagi's an award-winning freelance photojournalist, writer, and filmmaker who has covered war and unrest in the Middle East and Afghanistan since 2007. She lived in Kabul for over 5 years, where she worked for a variety of publications, such as the Sunday Times, the Financial Times, and the Telegraph. She also worked in Gaza, the West Bank, Israel, Eastern Ukraine, Bangladesh, Jordan, and Iraq. Her first book, War Gardens, which was published in 2018, explores current conflicts through the peaceful act of gardening. She produced and directed her first film, Afghan Army Girls, in 2016. Her films and photographs have also been on display at the Smithsonian Museum in Washington, D.C. Most recently, she produced, filmed, directed, and narrated The Gardeners of Kabul, a half-hour documentary for the BBC. Her aim has always been to give people a voice. In our conversation, Lalagi and I discussed the tragic story that inspired her to begin writing her first book, War Gardens. We also discussed the plight of women in Afghanistan and the powerful realization that we have many more threads connecting us with people in war-torn regions than differences. Lalagi also discusses the reality of day-to-day life in Kabul, where she lived some of her happiest times, and the role that reading, books, and technology play in her life. I'm really excited to have with us today Lalagi Snow, and who also goes by Lally. And Lally and I also met at the Festival of Literature in Dubai about a month and a half ago. So Lally, welcome.
Hi, thanks very much. Good evening. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Good evening. And thank you so much for Lally has an 8-year-old beautiful baby named Harry and is
8-month-old.
Did I say 8-year-old?
Yeah, not quite yet.
not quite yet. He's a growing boy though, and his dad's certainly tall. 8-month beautiful baby named Harry, and she stayed up. Thank you for staying up late because you're in England joining us.
You're welcome.
Lally is an award-winning photojournalist, writer, and filmmaker whose book I was very fortunate to be introduced to in the UAE at the festival, called War Gardens, A Journey Through Conflict in Search of Calm. And this is a really beautiful book. And I want to start with one small passage, Lally, that struck me on page 7. And you're referring to a specific garden in Afghanistan. And the man's name is Shah. His last name is Shah. I'm assuming it's his last name. I think of Shah's paradise garden. These two patches of green represent optimism and growth, and they counter the narrative that Afghanistan is a hostile, barren land soaked with blood, and of Afghans as a hopeless people blinded by war. I thought that was a really beautiful and insightful passage. And I wanted to start by asking you what the inspiration is behind, or was behind, your creating your book, War Gardens.
Well, it came about very organically. I was working in Kabul as a foreign correspondent, a photojournalist, a filmmaker. And you know, you're going out on assignment, working for different clients, whether it's newspapers or even NGOs, and the stories that you're coming across are really, really sad and very depressing, and at times very dangerous as well. And there was one particular story that I was covering And in the end, the newspaper that I was writing for, they didn't want it because something else happened, I think, in Syria. It was back in just after the Arab Spring. And once a story gets spiked like that, it very rarely moves. And I couldn't give it away for love nor money. And it was such a sad story. It was about child abuse. And I just thought, for the first time in my career, I could actually do something that does some good, and child protection agencies could go into where this was supposedly happening and try and change people's actions. And I literally couldn't give it away. People were saying that it wasn't quite for our readers, or that it wasn't very surprising. And then women's magazines, of course, they just said it was too depressing. And I felt so hopeless, because I thought, as a journalist, your job is to impart the news. Your job is to tell people what is going on around the world in these places, to make people understand. And in some respects, I think also to create empathy, because war can be very dehumanizing. And it's our job to make it human. And I just thought I'd failed completely if people weren't going to take this story. And I think at the time I was doing quite a lot of frontline work as well, with US Marines, British soldiers. And, you know, it's quite scary and dangerous at times. And whenever I came back to Kabul to my house, there was a lovely garden. And it was always a bit of a solace to stand in this garden. It's completely outside of the chaos of the outside world, the war, the polluted and hectic city. And the garden was very peaceful and a nice place to be. And a little idea just started germinating. And I thought, well, Afghans do actually love their gardens. And the opening passage that you read there is from Colonel Shirin Shah, who was an Afghan general in Helmand province, showing me his garden and how proud he was of it. And I thought, well, let's try and do a counter narrative. You know, the country is still, even to this day now, the country is at war. It's slightly crumbling. When I was seeing Colonel Shirin Shah's garden, it was 9 years ago. And let's try and turn things on its head. If the stories that I'm photographing and sending home are too, in quotation marks, depressing, then I, you know, I'll give you something happy. But I think at the same time, what I was also trying to do was look at conflict through something counterintuitive. And gardening is the exact opposite to war. It represents the polar opposite that everything that war represents. So I think I was trying to turn traditional war photography on its head, at the same time as also trying to create empathy with the people, you know, living through war. You know, not unlike us expats, Afghans, people in Palestine, people in Gaza, the West Bank, Ukraine, they don't have a chance to leave war. They don't have a chance to leave their homes. So, you know, for them, life goes on, and the chaos and destruction that surround them is part of their daily life. But life does go on, and they have to go to school, to university, to hospitals, to their jobs as lawyers or teachers or street cleaners, whatever. So it's kind of, I think I was just trying to say to readers and to viewers of the photographs, say, look, war is going on, but look, there are people just like you with the same hopes, the same fears, the same dreams, and to try and bring it home, I suppose. If people get bored of reading about war and conflict in the newspapers, well, read about it through something peaceful, and also try and understand it through a different lens, I suppose.
And if you, the story that you were working on that was not picked up, which seems, from what you're saying, which seems to be, to have, you know, inspired you to look at this difference. What was that story?
It was, I happened to be working with a newspaper as a photographer. And their journalist and I were in Herat, which is a city in the north west of Afghanistan, and we were looking at Herat's quite famous for women self-immolating, setting fire to themselves, and the plight of women is, I'm sure, has been well documented over your side of the pond. The plight of women is it's pretty bad for Afghans, and a lot of women in Herat were burning themselves as a way of escaping their terrible lives, because they were, you know, girls are married off very young, families don't work in the same way that our families work in the West. It's much more tribal structure. You know, you're more of a good as a woman than a human being. We were talking to a human rights lawyer And then we went to speak to a doctor in one of the hospitals, and he said, actually, cases of self-immolation have depleted because he put a blanket ban on any media coverage, national media coverage, so people stopped hearing about it as much and then being inspired to do it. But he said, sadly, the thing that people are doing more and more now is burning their children, which is such a horrific... We both sort of went, what do you mean they're burning their children? And he said, yeah. And he was a Canadian trained Afghan doctor. So he was speaking to us in English, and he said, yeah, I've seen these cases of children being brought in having severe burns. I can tell by the way that the burns are that they've been dunked in hot water or burning oil. And it's the most horrific thing, because it's, especially now as a new mother, it's so counter nature to want to do that. But it just shows, it just demonstrates how completely ghastly life is and was for so many of these young girls. And the idea of burning their child is a way of getting back at their mother-in-law or their husbands, both of whom most likely were very abusive, and they might have been the third wife in a massive family, and as such treated as a slave, and their own mother-in-laws, there's a cycle of abuse, because their own mother-in-laws would have probably treated them as badly as they were, and they probably would have gone on to treat their daughters-in-law just as badly. So that was you know, the horrific story in it. It was really, really grim. And there was a particular case of this child being brought in, and it was a hermaphrodite, and so neither, well, both female and male genitalia, and the mother-in-law had blamed the daughter-in-law, the mother, for this, said it was her fault, and the mother was only about 14 or 15 years old, and so she burnt the child, basically, and that was the story that I tried to write it for a sister newspaper, the Sunday one, and something else happened. They were like, this is going to be on the front page, this is an amazing story, and then something happened, I think, in the Middle East, and it got canned.
It's hard, Lali, it's hard to even imagine. I think it's hard for most of us to even fathom that. And as you said, as a new mother, and I had the chance to meet Harry, who's such a beautiful baby, to just imagine anyone doing that to any child, let alone their child. And as you said, an indication of how desperate things are. So I really appreciate that you felt a need to switch from that to something more hopeful. And you're describing something, this is really a world I was unfamiliar with, because you lived full time in Afghanistan for 5 years, is that correct?
Yeah, I worked there for 10.
And I didn't even know that was possible, that expats were living there at that time for 5 years. So what was that like? And this is, I mean, that's in the midst of a more tumultuous time than now, even, isn't it?
Yeah, although I think it's still quite tumultuous, just we don't hear about it as much because we have fewer troops there. It was, do you know what? It was really quite normal. And it's so surprising to people to hear that. But Kabul City is a big Central Asian city struggling to redefine itself. It's got municipal problems, it's got sewage problems, pollution, you know, traffic issues, and that's all obviously against the backdrop of insecurity. But it's also a big city, so while, you know, there might be an explosion that happens one morning, but, you know, if you're in a different part of town, it's like, I'm not familiar with LA, but I guess it might be, I'm familiar a bit with New York, so it might be like there was an explosion in Brooklyn, but you might be in Harlem, so how do you, you know, like, you hear about it, but you don't, it's not like around you all the time. And life there was, I don't think you got used to it pretty quickly. It sounds rather glib to say, but it was a bit like being a student again, because you're living with friends. I lived outside the wire with I didn't have any security. Lots of journalists who were freelance just lived, you know, a bit rough and ready. Whereas lots of aid agencies had security around them all the time. So I lived in a little house with some friends, and it was quite a transitory existence, I suppose, because people would come and go all the time. We had chickens in the garden at one point. We had a dog, which now lives with us in Dorset. And you go about your daily work, you go about your, you know, as you might as a student, you go to your lectures every day, your seminars, and then you come home and you talk to your mates and your friends. The only thing you really talk about is the work that you're doing, which is basically fascinating, no matter if you're working in policy, advocacy, journalism, the NGO world, humanitarian, all the daily grind that normally just gets at you, like parking or taxing the car or making sure the bins are out so that when the rubbish people come, that they, you know, gets taken away. All the stuff that you just grinds you down gets taken away from you because you live a charmed life with people looking after you in the form of, you know, we had two guards and a maid that came every day to do our cleaning, which I thought was ridiculous when I first got there, because I thought, God, of course we can clean up after ourselves, but it's so dusty that you need someone to, otherwise you just spend your whole time cleaning and not working. And then, you know, there are Western supermarkets. You could go and find all sorts of, you know, food that you're familiar with, but you could also experiment and go to the markets. And some of the produce in the markets in Kabul is extraordinary. So delicious. Kandahari pomegranates were just absolutely astounding. Especially coming from England, where everything's so tiny and like weedy in the shops. trying to think what else. The only thing that was really frustrating and got increasingly more frustrating is the lack of ability to move. So it wasn't really safe towards the end of my time there to walk around in the streets. So, you know, if you're counting your steps every day, they wouldn't be very much. So you would go to a gym in a 5-star hotel or something. But it really wasn't, you know, bombs falling every day and chaos. And, you know, it wasn't like a film at all. It was quite ordinary.
Do you, I asked you to inscribe this one copy of the book to Nazrin Gross, who's a friend of mine, who's a human rights activist, as you know, and I want to introduce you to her. And I'm struck by the inscription that you wrote to Nazrin: my happiest memories are from Kabul. I hope this brings back some of your own. And I was really struck by that statement, that some of your happiest memories in life are from this place that most people associate with war and destruction and terrorism and all these horrible things.
Well, I think a lot of that comes down to the friendships that you form out there. And while a lot of the day-to-day grind gets taken away, so does the, how do I say it without swearing? So does a lot of the veneer that people walk around with. So you form very, very strong friendships out there very, very quickly, much more so than anywhere else I've lived. And I lived in Argentina, I've lived in Bangladesh, I lived in Jordan, Paris, and obviously London. So I think that's probably what I meant. And there's a certain kind of light that falls every now and then where I live in England, and it reminds my future husband and I very much of the mornings of Kabul, when you'd wake up and it's always beautiful weather, much like LA, I imagine. But you'd just sort of wake up and there'd be a sort of promise to the day somehow. And, you know, the gardens that we had were, you know, really full of hope. And maybe that kind of fostered, you know, you start your day by walking through a garden to get out into the main road. But it's just such a place of contrasts, because some of my saddest memories are from there as well. And I'm not going to gloss over. It would be immature and irresponsible to gloss over the fact that, you know, at times it was incredibly frightening. And I'm very, very lonely at times as well. But I think that's probably where these amazing friendships and memories come from. But, you know, walking through the hills of Istalif outside Kabul city with friends and stopping on the side of a mountain to eat a chocolate bar, or the other sort of things we used to do at weekends, or going for a walk in the city on a lovely afternoon when it wasn't too dangerous, and going to take tea with a guy on Chicken Street, which is a tourist street, or was a tourist street for the hippie trail, and taking tea with Wahid, the guy who has the most amazing knowledge of carpets, and would make jasmine tea and make you eat pistachio nuts, and wouldn't force you to buy a carpet if you didn't really want to. Of course, you end up buying all the carpets, but I think this is what I meant. But like I say, it would be irresponsible to say it was, you know, all roses and sweetness and light.
Well, it's wonderful, Lolly, and it's a beautiful book, and I'm very grateful to have it. And as you know, my book, The World Is Just a Book Away, is about the books, how books and reading inspired prominent people, including Nazarene, who's in my book. And I'd like to ask you just briefly about the importance that reading has played and or continues to play in your life.
Mm. Well, I mean, it's incredibly important as a writer and as a human being. I was brought up reading, and I was a fast reader, so I was a couple of years ahead of my peer group in primary school. And reading for me is so important. I'm surrounded by books in my office, but it's so important because it's not only the sharing of ideas that you might learn from, you know, reading something you have to read at school. It opens up, and it's noting down history as well. Without reading, without writing, there would be no history, and it's such a huge part of civilized culture. That I think it also opens up worlds, either through this education and opens your own world up, or more figuratively in your imagination. And that's kind of key. So it's unlike watching a film where everything's on the screen in front of you and the director's done the imagining for you. They've said, okay, the chair is this color, it's in this corner, the light is like this, the person looks like this. You know, with reading, if you're reading a novel or a story, you know, yeah, fiction, you can make it all up in your head, and the author's voice helps you, guides your imagination, and what you imagine is probably very different to, could be very different to the person next to you. So I think that's why it's so special. It requires you to do the imagining, and you can also really engage with the author, and you understand who they are as a sort of person in their own right, just as an author. So that's why reading's important to me. And it's something I enjoy. I love reading. I love getting into a good book and just, you become friends with it. And you read a good book, and then when you finished it, you mourn the loss of the characters and the author's voice. I'm like, damn it, I need to read that again.
No, will there be a sequel? Will there be something that the story can continue?
Exactly.
One thing I learned about Afghanistan through Nazarene was the extremely, extremely high rates of illiteracy, especially under the Taliban. What was your experience, or perhaps more so, what in being in a culture and spending so much of your life in a culture where there were such, or perhaps still are, such high illiteracy rates? What do you think the importance of literacy itself is?
It's hugely important because it's not just you know, being able to read and write and count up to 10. It's problem solving. It's the transferable skills that come with that. And so often I've seen it in people who are illiterate in Afghanistan, and it's almost like they, I hope I don't offend anyone by saying this, but it's almost like they're half of who they are because they don't have the means to express themselves. They don't have the means to cognitively show, sort of explore their world. It's like they're sort of deaf and dumb and mute all at the same time. And I've also seen it with, you know, there are a couple of organizations that deal really well with literacy. And there's a girls' boarding school, for example, in Kabul. And they have extraordinary levels of literacy. You've got this very precocious 10-year-old girls walking around reading Pride and Prejudice. And you see the confidence that it gives them in English. You know, these are girls from, I don't know, Kandahar or Helmand or something. So it's, you know, the confidence that it gives people to be literate is huge.
I agree. And it's why it's been my mission. As someone who grew up as a reader and continues to read a great deal, can you think of a book that has really touched you or inspired you in a certain way?
I can't actually think of a single one. So I've got several because they're all things that I've read fairly recently, so they're fresh in my head. One is a book called Moon Tiger by Penelope Lively, which is a writer reconstructing her life on her deathbed. And it's the way the author reconstructs a life, is the narrative storytelling is so beautiful. And at the end, I was lost for words for a good half an hour. I think I sat down and cried and then couldn't speak and then kind of clung on to the book for a bit. Another book is by an American author called Anything is Possible by Elizabeth Strout, which I've read twice now. And it's short stories that are interlinked into a novel. And it's an extraordinary, she's one of my favorite writers. The way she describes things is so pared back and yet so dense. It's, you come away from, you read one story and you go, how did she do that? And, you know, as someone who's trying to write fiction, I admire her a lot. And then another one is something I came across quite by accident. It's Daphne du Maurier, but one of her works that isn't that well known, called The Parasites. And it's the way she jumps between different characters all at the same time is really avant-garde for the time when she was writing. And extraordinary. And it's just, it's not a particularly nice story, but it's how to write prose. And then there's I Capture the Castle by Dodie Smith, which is one I stayed up till 2 o'clock in the morning to finish and then cried. And then I'm actually about to reread a book called Anatomy of a Soldier by Harry Parker, who's actually a friend who was very badly injured in Afghanistan. And it's a novel about a soldier who's blown up, but written from the point of view of the objects which both blew him up and brought him back to life and brought him back together. And it's a very, very powerful, especially as it's, you know, written from someone who has this in-depth knowledge. It's incredibly powerful. But then I always go back to The Odyssey, and that's a book that I carried with me in Afghanistan along with a book of poetry. It's a book that I reread every couple of years, and it's the universal story that, actually, funnily enough, Anything is Possible. You could read the Elizabeth Strout book and say it's a book like The Odyssey. But it's the universal story of homecoming, a hero's return. And there are so many layers to it. It's not just the level. It's not just Odysseus' adventures home. It's when he gets home. It's his relationship with his wife, his relationship with his son, the gods, their immortal playing fields. It's an incredible story. So any of those, I highly recommend.
That gives me a list. I haven't read any of those books, so I'm glad to have a new list of books. And I hope for our readers also some books to consider reading that they haven't read before. And it's very interesting. You mentioned The Odyssey. My son's 14, and he's reading it for the first time now. And really being drawn into it, and just for me to be able to, I probably read it when I was 15, but for me to observe how it's drawing him in and how much he loves it is really wonderful to see.
It's an amazing story. I'm writing a novel based on it at the moment, trying to anyway. It's taking me quite a long time. Currently having a baby takes a long time.
Are you? I have a feeling the answer to this is yes, but do you read books to Harry now?
I do, yeah, absolutely. And we my future husband and I have made a point of doing it from a very young age, even though he's 8 months and he really doesn't know what we're doing. But we have a blanket ban, at least I do, on using a cell phone around him, because you just get completely distracted by it. And then before you know it, you've actually drowned out your baby's crying or calls for attention. So that's, and also I don't want him to be jealous of a phone. I'd rather him be jealous of a book, because then at least he can get into his own books, and he won't be getting a cell phone for a very, very long time, if at all, ever. I read Beatrix Potter, I read Emily Hughes, and John started to read, he's reading Roald Dahl to him already. So, yes. Yeah.
I remember having this conversation with you in Dubai about the ban on cell phones around Harry, that you didn't want him to be looking over his shoulder and wondering what mommy and daddy are distracted by or looking at instead of him. And I think that's a really beautiful message for people to think about, that of course these phones are wonderful, and look, we're so blessed to be able to do this. You're in Dorset, I'm in Los Angeles. Yeah. We can have this wonderful use of technology. But a reminder of the place that it holds in our life, and that it doesn't control our lives.
Exactly.
I think is a beautiful message. Lolly, this has been a really wonderful conversation. I know you probably have things to tend to and have to get to bed, so that your baby will probably get you up quite early. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
I think only that just returning to the theme of gardens, because War Gardens isn't just a book about gardening, and I think that's something that people misunderstand about it. And it's really that it is a book about, it's a book about people, and it's a book about people that we can all identify with, and we all should identify with, and that. But the message, I suppose, behind garden, the garden book, is that to grow something out of nothing, that's something for survival. It's mental survival, and that gardens can be destroyed, and they can also bloom again. So the metaphor there for anyone, and it's not just, you don't have to look at that in a sense of conflict. It could be, you know, day to day life. Don't let things get you down, really. And I think it's just the idea that just life will always go on. So anyone who gardens in a state of war, or in a state of crisis, it's almost like they sort of, they're above, I'm not explaining it very well. It's almost like they can just say, well, like, you guys go and be chaotic and go off and fight. I've got something better to do, and that's to grow something. And to grow something out of nothing, that's really something. So I think that's what I wanted to add.
It's really beautiful. Thank you, Lally. Thank you for joining us today, and give my best to John and Harry, and I look forward to staying in touch.
Great. Thanks, James. Great to speak.
You've been listening to a podcast production of AW360, the year-round content destination from Advertising Week. Visit AW360 at 360.advertisingweek.com, and be sure to check out the other AW360 podcasts now available on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, and Stitcher. Producers on this podcast are Jack Hirschman and Richard Larson, with music provided by Audio Network. For more information on Advertising Week, the world's largest gathering of advertising, marketing, and technology leaders, now in 6 markets across the globe, visit www.advertisingweek.com.